This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. You're listening to The Lines Between Us, our series about inequality in our region. It's been the better part of a year since our first episode of The Lines Between Us aired. 38 episodes later, we've discussed housing, wealth, jobs, and criminal justice with dozens of guests. We've also heard from many of you, our listeners. Your voices have been just as important throughout this year-long series. You've told us what issues are most important to you, where you think we should dig a little further, and what areas you believe still need to be explored. On our website, linesbetweenus.org, we have a page titled Your Stories. Here we feature what listeners write and say about episodes and your stories about what inequality looks like from where you are. Today we pause to share some of this feedback on the air. Listener Barbara Cutco lives in the North Baltimore neighborhood of Govens. She sent us an email related to what she calls transit inequity in the MTA local bus system. In our episode last January titled Getting to Work, we had examined how the city's transportation system relates to access to jobs. Assistant producer Jamila Kay phoned Barbara Cutco and asked her to read her letter appealing for the bus system to become more efficient and more inviting to more people.
I am a local bus rider. In cosmopolitan cities like New York, London, and Chicago, the buses are used by a cross-section of the population to get to areas not reachable by light rail or subway. People travel on the web of connected transit routes that make getting around the city possible, while cutting air and water pollution by taking cars off the road. They view the transit as one system where riders move from one mode to another, not one mode for us and another for them. In Baltimore, the buses are primarily used by the poor, the elderly, and the handicapped. The preponderance of riders are people of color. There is a stigma attached to local buses. Automobile drivers don't consider using the bus. Thus, they never learn where the routes go and how to use them. They have a choice, and they choose their cars. Most bus riders have no choice. They must put up with an often unreliable, overcrowded, and inconvenient system. Being poor, old, and handicapped, they have no political voice to demand the share of transportation funding needed to make it a first-class system. Who will advocate for bus riders? In this past legislative session, the state approved an enormous spending bill for improvements in public transportation. I hear of many transit groups seeking a portion of the state funds for new and improved metro, light rail, MARC train, and commuter bus lines. I hear about more free circulator buses and a trolley up Charles Street. Who could oppose those? After all, they will help more affluent people get into and out of the city, as well as tourists and folks at leisure to travel about among the sites. But they won't create the equitable, efficient, interconnected transit system the region desperately needs. They will only worsen the lines between us. I think an educational campaign entitled Go Green, Go Bus should be mounted. Get people out of their cars and walking more. Let bikers know that all buses have bike racks. Eliminate need for more parking lots, cut back on traffic congestion and air pollution, and paint the buses a beautiful emerald green to remind everyone that each of us can contribute to a cleaner and more equitable planet.
Barbara Cutco, responding to The Lines Between Us on 88.1, I'm Sheila Cast. Our March 29th episode about Baltimore's blue light police cameras prompted several comments. We wanted to examine whether police cameras actually make neighborhoods safer or whether they just send a message to more affluent residents to avoid certain neighborhoods. As we do every week on linesbetweenus.org, we posted a question of the week. The question for March 29th was, do you want a blue light camera on your block? Jessica McNeely of Highlandtown answered the question with a no. According to Open Baltimore's map of crime cameras, which is posted on our website, Highlandtown appears to be camera-free, and McNeely would like to keep it that way. She wrote to us, quote, I hate the flashing blue lights. They make me feel like there is something to be scared of and cause me to be vigilant. Grown men tell me never to go into neighborhoods with flashing blue lights. I call these men cowards. When I see little kids walking under the blue lights on their way to school, it makes me cry. They don't even realize yet that their city is stigmatizing them as criminals. Close quote. Highlandtown did have a crime camera at one time, but Kevin L. Bernhardt, president of the Highlandtown Community Association, said the community decided to have it removed in January 2011. Bernhardt emailed us, quote, We used to have a crime camera, but after being instructed that it was not monitored by a central camera monitoring site and was only usable when the hard drive was recovered from the camera after an event occurred, we petitioned the police department to remove it. It was the thought of the community that if the camera is not being actively used to stop crime, it was not worth having the blue flashing light lowering the property values. We would be interested in a security camera if it was actually monitored and did not include the obnoxious blue flashing light that the previous one had, unquote. But Diana Mitchell was less concerned with the stigmatizing effect of the cameras. She emphasized their potential for prevention. Her answer to our question was yes. She posted to Twitter, quote, The newer cameras do not have blue lights. A crime deterrent is just that, unquote. On 88.1, this is The Lines Between Us on Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. We're hearing excerpts from listeners' comments and your stories. We don't know the race of some of our commenters, and we don't necessarily embrace their views as our own. On June 14th, The Lines Between Us aired an episode on police and community relations. While the show was still on the air, a listener who asked to remain anonymous called to express her pleasure with the changes that one of our guests, Baltimore Police Lieutenant Colonel Melvin Russell, was planning to make as head of the department's Community Partnerships Unit. When we reached her by phone, she gave us an example of why she feels the relationship between residents and police officers is strained, a lack of trust.
My brother was at the one of the fast food restaurants on Cold Spring near Park Heights and was walking home and was attacked by two men at gunpoint, and they took his money and his food. So I was waiting for him at his house, and when he got there, he was visibly upset, and I asked him what happened, and he said that he had been robbed at gunpoint. And I said, well, let me call the police. And he said, no, I don't want to call the police. I said, you have to call the police because this may happen to someone else. So I called the police, and they came, and they listened to the story, said they were going to take him up to the police station. I think it's Western District on Reisterstown Road. So I went up to the police station to find out what was happening with them. And I was sitting on the outside of the interviewing room, and they were coercing him to say that the reason he had been on the corner was because he was selling drugs. And they kept making him trying to write the statement over and over again. So I sat there for at least an hour and a half listening to them drilling him and interrogating him. And then another lady came in and said that she had been robbed at gunpoint on the same corner. At that point, I asked the detective, is he being detained or is he going to be arrested or what? And they said no. And I told my brother to come on. Yes, he's okay, but if something happens, he does not feel comfortable in going to the police.
The listener expressed some hope that the community walks Lieutenant Colonel Russell described might establish trust on both sides.
I think it's awful that whenever young black men are confronted with anything, the first thing that the police jump to, the conclusion is that it's drugs. So that's why I think the community needs to get together and as they walk the beat, they'll get to know some of the people in the neighborhood and know who they're dealing with. I would like to see more and more community leaders and churches come together in order to get rid of the drugs in our city. and work with the police department. Basically, not jump to conclusions that every time you see an Afro-American man, he's not selling drugs, taking drugs, on drugs. Give everybody a fair shake and treat everybody with some type of respect and dignity.
For the May 24th episode called The Road from Ex-Offender to Employee, senior producer Lawrence Lanahan talked to several people who had returned to Baltimore from prison. He met them at the Jericho Reentry Program in early May. Keith Evans said even though he served his time, he feels some people won't stop punishing him for his past mistakes.
It's great being home. It's great starting over. It's great doing a lot of things, but it's hard also. It's very, very hard. It's very hard to try to adapt because now people got this stigma about you now and this and the way they look at you, no matter if they don't say it, you know. It's hard for people to give ex-cons a real second chance, even your own family.
Scott Myers had been out of prison for more than 6 months after serving 13 months on a heroin distribution charge. He is working at a hotel just outside the city. But for many people with a record, he says, finding work and getting on one's feet seems nearly impossible.
85% of people don't even call you back. Because it's so hard to move forward when you come home. I mean, you don't have a place to stay most of the time unless you have family, and which my parents are dead. I mean, you just have so many obstacles. You don't have any money coming in. I mean, they give you $50 when you come out of prison, and I spend 35 of that going to the place I'm staying at, you know what I mean, and a cab ride home.
Many of our episodes have touched on religious, racial, and cultural diversity. A listener named Zodic wrote from Northwest Baltimore and suggested we further explore this topic and look at it from his neighborhood's perspective. In an email, he wrote, quote, I wondered if you would consider doing a story on the unique dynamic of Northwest Baltimore. Nearly the entire population is Orthodox Jewish or Black. In many ways, the two communities are like ships passing in the night, but there are some areas where we work together or otherwise cross paths. There are even a few Black Orthodox Jews, unquote. To share your story with us and with each other, visit linesbetweenus.org. There are lots of ways to share your story. Email, phone, video, audio, Twitter, Facebook. Just go to linesbetweenus.org and click on Your Stories. Thanks for listening to this week's episode of The Lines Between Us. I'm Sheila Cast. Quick break, then, what's happening to the middle class in Baltimore? Stay tuned to 88.1.
I'm assistant producer Jamila Kay. You're listening to Maryland Mornings, The Lines Between Us series on WYPR 88.1 in Baltimore. Visit our website, linesbetweenus.org, to hear more stories, to see maps that reveal the lines in your neighborhood, and to participate in the discussion. Thanks for downloading this week's show. Now back to the podcast.
This is The Lines Between Us on Maryland Morning, WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Middle-class neighborhoods are disappearing in America, according to recent research. In 1970, two-thirds of families lived in middle-income neighborhoods. By 2007, that had slipped to 44%. Meanwhile, the proportion of neighborhoods that are poor has doubled, as has the proportion of rich neighborhoods. We have an animated map of the Baltimore region that shows those changes from 1970 to now. The northeast corner seems to be holding on just a bit more tightly to its middle-class status, but things could go either way. What will it take to remain middle-class? And what does middle-class mean to the people who live there? Back in February, Maryland Morning senior producer Lawrence Lanahan picked two census tracts around the Hamilton neighborhood and went to visit them.
I was born and raised in Baltimore. I love my city. I wear it on my sleeve. Anybody that know me can tell you I love Baltimore to death.
That's 39-year-old Dimitrik Farmer. I caught up with him in front of his house on Century Road, up a steep hill from Bel Air Road, as he was getting out of his car. He'd just finished a 5:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. shift at a city transfer station.
I always like envision myself buying a home, and I said, you know, welcome to the middle class, but people tell me, no, you're not middle class, you're just one paycheck from being broke.
When we zoomed in on those two census tracts on our neighborhood income maps, we noticed that one has remained low to middle income since 1970. The other, where Dimitri Farmer lives, slipped from high middle income down to poor.
I think it's all about perception. I mean, where do you think you land on the chart? I don't know. I don't know. Sometimes you tell somebody if you make 40 grand, they might like, no, you're not middle class. But I would say the middle class, you know, far as salary range concerned, probably would start at around about 45 on up.
Farmer bought his row house in 2010 when he was working for a carpet cleaning company. He's feeling more middle class lately. When he took that job with the city's Bureau of Solid Waste last year, it was a bump up in pay for him. The data says that this part of Hamilton is poor, at least compared to the median income around the region. But this newcomer says his quiet street is a blessing and a move up.
People in general, just, you know, you tell them what neighborhood you live in, they're like, I don't think so. But it's all about perception, what you think. So I really believe it's middle class to me. And I'm, like I said, I'm happy to live in this neighborhood.
Hamilton resident Sheila Ebeline loves her neighborhood too. So much so that she's become president of the Glenham-Belhar Community Association, which represents the two census tracts we looked at in Baltimore's northeast corner. But if Dimitri Farmer feels like he's moving up, Ebeline is worried about slipping down.
I would call ourselves the struggling middle class.
She and her husband bought their house from the estate of his grandfather, who had the house built back in the 50s. So they've seen the changes of the past few decades.
You look at the neighborhood and you look at the people that used to live in this neighborhood or other neighborhoods that were middle class. You look at Bethlehem Steel. What's happened to them? What's happened to the car industry? They were well-paying jobs that offered entry-level, non-skilled workers opportunities to learn a skill and to obtain a solid salary or hourly rate with healthcare benefits, etc. So, vapor. We are a snapshot of what is happening in America. Things are becoming very polar, and the middle class is shrinking.
The people on Sheila's block in her husband's grandfather's day had jobs with BGE and the city and federal governments.
It was a good, healthy mix of high-earning blue-collar and maybe low-earning white-collar. You know, solidly middle-class.
Today, she says the mix of jobs is similar, maybe a little less white-collar.
My husband works in a white-collar job, but he's on the low end of the earning scale, and with our expenses, that brings us down to blue-collar level.
But there's a difference, she says, between her husband's grandfather's Hamilton and hers. Those middle-class salaries just don't go as far.
The economy, what they have to spend and the amount that they have to work.
Her neighbors are clinging tightly to whatever work they have, worried they won't find another job.
I mean, I know several people in the neighborhood that have a second job. Well, believe it or not, my husband, who has an MBA and works at NASA, actually took a second job for a while at Walmart as a cashier. There are other people who will take a weekend job at some place that's clerical or whatever. Everybody's trying to supplement their income with something else.
Another difference she's noticed in Hamilton these days is that there are fewer children around. She understands. When her son and daughter were toddlers back in the 1990s, her family, despite some financial turmoil, still had options.
One was picking up and moving to the county. Another one was private education. The third was public education. And I had been watching the standardized test scores just fall and fall and fall at the school that she would have been attending, at the public school.
That school was across the street from her daughter's preschool program.
And I would park along the street and listen to the children who were being dismissed. And I was really upset to find that there was a lot of profanity and disruptive behavior.
Sheila grew up in East Baltimore and went to parochial school. Her husband had gone to public school just across the county line in Parkville. He resisted the private school option.
So one day, when I was picking up Elise in the spring from her preschool program, I had him come with me and I just put the windows of the car down. And he almost like had a heart attack and fell in the street. And he went, wait a minute. And I said, these are children that are K through 8. And he just was shocked.
Parochial school it was. But many of her neighbors take the county option.
What I've seen over the past 20 years will be an individual move-in They'll invest money in their house. It'll look fantastic. They'll be great neighbors. They'll either get married or enter into a relationship. Many times after that, they will have a small child. And somewhere between age 2 and 4, the for sale sign will go up.
To this community association president, whether a middle-class neighborhood can remain middle-class isn't just about the jobs the adults have. It's about the bonds that they form when they come together around their children's activities and schooling. Sheila Ebeline's children are now 18. She and her husband are proud to have raised them in Northeast Baltimore. They just wish more parents felt they could do the same.
Maryland Morning Senior Producer Lawrence Lanahan. That's it for The Lines Between Us today. We hope you'll take a look at our animated neighborhood income map. It's at linesbetweenus.org. On 88.1, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. Up next, a remembrance of poet Lucille Clifton. Stick around.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Lines Between Us, WYPR's year-long exploration of inequality in the Baltimore region. This is Maryland Morning Senior Producer Lawrence Lanahan. Now, join the conversation at facebook.com/thelinesbetweenus. Or tell us your story at linesbetweenus.org. The Lines Between Us is made possible by grants from Associated Black Charities, Cohen Opportunity Fund, Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation, Baltimore Community Foundation, and Open Society Institute Baltimore, as well as support from members of the WYPR Board of Directors. I hope you'll join us again on Friday at 9 a.m. on 88.1 FM in the Baltimore region, and everywhere else, streaming live at WYPR.org. Have a great day.